Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Lahav Harkov, senior contributing editor and diplomatic reporter, and I'm here, as always, with editor-in-chief Yaakov Katz. Yaakov, I know some of your kids are bigger and some are smaller. Have they done their school supply shopping yet?
We've started with the school supply shopping, but I'm not sure that we're going to have to use it so quickly because as of now, it does not look like the school year will be commencing as it is supposed to on September 1st, which is next Thursday. And as they say in, what is it, in Kohelet, in Chadash Tachat HaShemesh, right? There's nothing new under the sun. Well, every summer, as we know, there's the threat of a school strike.
This time it looks serious, though. I mean, it's the younger teachers and also the older teachers. Not the older and younger teachers, I mean the schools. The elementary schools and the high schools, which have separate unions. They're both threatening to go on strike. And the elementary schools and the preschools, those teachers already were on strike at the end of the last school year. So like the last week of school or so, there was no school.
Have you noticed, Lahav, that now everyone's like threatening a strike? So you got like these are the lower school. So your kids who are going to be in public kindergarten, nursery, ganim, and one of my kids who's going to be still in elementary school, and then I have middle school and high school. So now the middle school, high school teachers are threatening to strike, and the interns in the hospitals are threatening to strike. So that has nothing to do, obviously, with the school, but like, why not, right? Jump on the bandwagon and everyone should just strike.
I do wonder, I mean, in terms of timing. Yeah. In terms of timing, I mean, for the teachers, the timing is obvious, September 1st, but it's also, I think, maybe convenient that it's before an election that they think maybe they can try and squeeze more, you know, in order to avoid a crisis right before the election.
So they think, you know, September 1st is looming. And of course, us parents who have had kids home now for 2 months and we love our kids. Oh, of course we love our kids. But we also would love for them to get back to school, right? Because it's like...
Yeah, but it's also like the uncertainty, right? Like this is also like the kind of thing that drove me crazy during the last like year or so of COVID, right? Where like, you don't know, like one day your kid could come home and then you could find out they can't go back for 10 days because someone in their class had COVID. So it's like the same thing where like, we're getting ready for the first day of school, but who knows when they're going to actually go to school. You can't plan for it.
You know, if you think about it for a moment, there's something about this country that just doesn't want stability. Right. It wants, like, you know, if you go back to the early years of Israel, and there's still some politicians who kind of play on this, like, you know, like we're all about to be destroyed and there's all these enemies that surround us. And therefore we can only think about the day or the week. We can't be strategic. We can't plan out a transportation grid or a proper education system.
Israelis tend not to write wills or buy life insurance. It's like the same kind of thing. People don't want to plan in advance. Right. There's something in the culture.
So the same thing here is like, why should we be certain of school starting? You know, we should just come to terms with the fact that maybe it will, maybe it won't, who knows? And, you know, that's just the way we're supposed to live our lives in this country. I say that, of course, with sarcasm, right? But if that's not coming over the microphone at the moment, it's insane. It's crazy. I mean, just a word about, I have good friends who are teachers, good friends who are high school principals. They deserve a lot more money. They're working very hard and they're not getting compensated enough. I don't know that this is the way to do it. The problem is that the government does not, still not value education where it should be. And that's a problem.
I mean, I think that the government made a fair offer to the teachers in terms of having higher starting salaries in order to attract young people to become teachers. But then the later raises would be like achievement based, right? Based on, I'm not sure exactly what the criteria are. But the teachers unions refused. They want raises for the more experienced teachers, regardless of, you know, what kind of grades their students are getting. They don't seem to care as much about the younger teachers. And their idea is that, like, experience itself is good. Which, like, when you have an experienced worker, yes, often experience is better, right? Like, you're a better teacher, you're a better journalist, you're a better all kinds of things, doctor, if you have experience. But at the same time, I'm sure we all know older teachers who are kind of lazy and aren't so good at their jobs, but because you get like tenure for this in this country, like they just are coasting. And so I think like it's reasonable to have those standards, and especially because the level of education in Israel, and you would think it would be otherwise considering that Jews value education very highly, but it is not good in international tests.
No. And in comparison to other OECD countries, we're also not doing that well. So, I mean, there's a lot of problems also. The classes being so packed, right, with like, you know, you could have classes with 30 kids. I mean, what kind of teacher can manage 30 kids? Teach, discipline, speak to parents, grade papers, give out assignments. I mean, it's just not. And then you have kids who fall through the cracks. Listen, hopefully we'll talk next week. And our listeners will be able to celebrate with us that school will be starting on next Thursday, or we'll talk next week and you and I will fetch a little more about it. Right. I mean, you know, those are kind of the two options that we have on the table right now. So we'll have to figure it out, but don't worry, Lahav, because you know what? There's something much bigger to worry about right now than school starting on September 1st. Our old friend Iran is back big time in the headlines. And a deal might be happening, a deal might not be happening. Israel's upset with the deal, but not upset enough that Lapid's getting on a plane and people think he should get on a plane. So give us the latest from Iran land here in Israel.
Okay.
Where do things stand?
To back up a little, so the EU, which is the coordinator of the Iran talks, they offered, like about 2 weeks ago, a quote-unquote final draft of the deal. The point was that this is final. Iran needs to accept it. The expression that Lapid and like his people keep using is take it or leave it. The deal was supposed to be take it or leave it. But Iran being Iran, and really this is just like their typical behavior in these talks, they drive a hard bargain. They came back with a yes, but they had all sorts of changes and demands that they still wanted. They felt that it didn't meet their demands. And so it's still a negotiation. And so it's now in the hands of the U.S., which examined it and hasn't given it their answer back to the EU yet, because, you know, Iran and the U.S. don't talk directly. And Israel's doing its best to try to have some kind of an influence, and basically to stop the U.S. from signing the deal, because it's just, in so many ways, is not good for Israel. I mean, it's just the non-proliferation benefits of the deal start to expire in 2 years. They expire fully by 2030.
Right.
And of course, even though this deal isn't quote unquote longer and stronger, which was the US's original goal, which it has since dropped, even though those, you know, you don't have added benefits to the deal, Iran is getting just as much sanctions relief as it got in 2015. Lapid is estimating that they're going to get $100 billion in their economy every year. And we all know what Iran spends its money on. It's not on improving the life of its citizens. It's on terrorizing the rest of the world. So, you know, not a good deal.
Islamic Jihad will get a nice upgrade, right?
Right.
If they get that $100 billion. And we just saw what they did over a period of a few days here. So imagine what another few tens of millions of dollars coming from the Iranian patrons would do. But what I'm hearing is like there, you know, we know a couple of things, right? We know that there seems to be a deal that's happening and it's close. Americans are supposed to be giving their answer any day now. And, it seems like they're going to move forward. Israel's in a last-ditch effort to try to pressure and move the needle a little back to what Biden had originally promised of longer and stronger in terms of a deal, or at least back to the original JCPOA, but not something that's worse than that.
There was no way that it wasn't going to be worse than the original JCPOA, because the minute you drop longer and stronger and you just go back to the original JCPOA, which is more or less what they're doing now, it's worse because it's shorter,
right?
Like
it's
the JCPOA is a 15-year deal, and this is an 8-year deal with a major milestone in 2 years.
My question is this. So, you know, Bibi Netanyahu, he's waiting in the wings, and he's gonna, if there is a deal, we know what he's gonna say right away. Yep, you know, it's because Lapid was prime minister. So the Americans took advantage of him and the Europeans took advantage of him. Now, I'm old enough to remember that there was a prime minister from Israel who flew to America in 2015 to try to stop a deal, actually spoke before the joint session of Congress and failed to stop that deal. And that was called the JCPOA. And that prime minister was Netanyahu. But either way, Iran will become the centerpiece, I would think, of what will be his campaign against Lapid. Does Lapid have what to say in return? Is he doing enough, do you think? Can he do more?
I mean, first of all, we can argue, like you said, that Netanyahu didn't stop the Iran deal either. You know, once he had a more comfortable president to work with, which was Trump, then he was able to you know, be one of the things that helped convince Trump to leave the deal. But, you know, I think it's very easy for Lapid to say back, well, you didn't stop the deal either. So I wonder, though, how strong a campaign message Iran is at this point.
You think people don't care? You don't think it's like the issue? Remember, also 2015, when Bibi went to Washington, it was just a couple of weeks away from an election as well.
I know. I think that Netanyahu at the time as prime minister really succeeded in keeping it on the agenda and making it the thing everyone talks about all the time. But here it's not leading the news anymore. And I can tell you, because I watch at least two news channels every night and I'm waiting for them to talk about Iran, because that's what I'm writing about. And it takes them like 10, 15 minutes to get to it. It's not the top of people's minds. What's the top of people's minds is the teacher strike, really.
Right. But so you should, you should be careful watching two news shows a night. Did you read that article on the Jerusalem Post website?
I saw Wednesday.
Yeah, right, I forget the headline at the moment, but basically how what news? Oh, too much news consumption, it could cause physical ill being. Now that might be self defeating, you know, that we're actually publishing that article.
Right. But, do you ever see A Clockwork Orange?
Yes.
You know, he's like forced to watch like all those things. His eyelids are like held open and stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's sometimes my husband jokes that that's my job, like to be that person that I have to just follow the news all day long, whether I want to or not.
As the editor of this newspaper, I do have to say, we do not have contraptions that keep your eyes open to watch news, right? So we don't force you to do that. Okay.
No, but I do have to watch a lot of news and read and listen.
I mean, look, I hear you. I think that people are not that interested in it, and it's still, the election is very much a BB yes, BB no, you know, right left camp type of thing. But Iran is something that has always felt to me like, you know, it's the big bad kind of wolf, and it gets Israelis kind of jittery, right? And it does get under the skin, and it makes people fear. And that's a good tool when you're running an election campaign.
Yeah, it's a good tool for Netanyahu. He knows how to play on that. And he knows in general to play on security issues. And Lapid, you know, even though we got through this Gaza operation, I think, very well. But in general, he doesn't really have much in terms of security credentials. And so I'm sure that Netanyahu will try to play that up.
But what I also want to hear from you, though, is... So Lapid sends Eyal Hulata, who's his national security advisor, former top guy in the Mossad. Benny Gantz is off this weekend to Florida, and then he's going to Washington. He's meeting with people in CENTCOM, in the military, and then he's going to meet with apparently the national security advisor of the president, Jake Sullivan. Lapid, we know, has spoken with Olaf Scholz in Germany and Emmanuel Macron in Paris and probably some other people who we don't yet know about. So there seems to be a lot of activity going on. Do you think he could do more, or he is doing... What needs to be done, and it's just he's keeping it at a lower volume than the way Netanyahu did things back in 2015.
I mean, I think he made a really interesting statement about Biden, which it's in my eyes, it meaning the Iran deal, does not meet the standards set by Biden himself, preventing Iran from becoming a nuclear state. That is Lapid like walking a tightrope here. He is trying, on the one hand, not to criticize Biden, you know, and not get into a confrontation with him. But on the other hand, to say, if you do this, you are breaking a promise that you made to us. Right. And it's a promise he's made in public. So yes, he could go further. He could go the way Netanyahu went and had an adversarial relationship with, you know, whoever is in the White House. Back then it was Obama, now it's Biden. I don't know. A while ago, Herb Kanin, who's like our chief analyst, I believe is his title, he wrote an article and this analysis where he said, you know, whether you're like really aggressive about it, like Netanyahu, or whether you're more behind the scenes about it, like, well, it was Bennett at the time, but Lapid has the same policy. Right. The U.S. is going to do what it thinks is the right thing to do. And that's where I think we are with this, because it's true that Lapid and Bennett haven't been as like loud and angry the way Netanyahu were, but they talk to Washington every day practically and constantly discuss this issue with them. So it's not that they're not getting their message across. I think it's just that the Biden administration really wants this deal.
You know, and one of the arguments that they're making is, you know, obviously on the one hand, this would be bad politically for Lapid and for his camp in the election, because it would give this ammo to Netanyahu. I'm sure they're making that argument to the Biden folks. But also, I wonder how it would play out for the midterms, right? The Democrats are kind of on up and coming a bit in some of the races. You know, this could be harmful to Democrat, you know, to swing states where there's some congressional or Senate votes that will could determine if the Democrats keep the Senate, keep the House, or lose one or lose both. Right. And Iran doesn't help them with that.
Yeah. There's a strong case to be made that this is going to have to be brought before Congress for review. Congress isn't going to ratify it because it's not a treaty. But there's still a law that if the U.S. is lifting sanctions on Iran, Congress has to review it. And that would make, you know, all of these members of Congress who are up for reelection sort of liable. You know, it would put them in the forefront of this issue of Iran right before an election. And I think that there's a strong possibility that, you know, like Steny Hoyer or Chuck Schumer will say to Biden, like, not till after the midterms. But the midterms are, of course, in 2.5 months. Right. And, you know, the deal is on the table. The quote unquote final deal is on the table right now. So, and Iran, you know, is not slowing down its nuclear program one bit. It's turned off all of the IAEA cameras. Time is of the essence. So it's going to be a really tough sell for the Biden administration.
Iran just never, you know, is the gift that never, that doesn't stop giving in terms of news. And it's just always been there. And I guess sadly will continue to be there as well in the years and definitely in the weeks to come. You'll have to bear with us as we talk more about this.
I want to say like one more thing when we're talking about U.S. politics and Iran, that this is a period in which Iran is flagrantly threatening U.S. citizens on U.S. soil, right? There was Iranians arrested for trying to kill former National Security Advisor John Bolton. There's a price on the head of former Secretary of State Pompeo, and he's under constant Secret Service protection. And of course, Salman Rushdie, who was stabbed in New York. And that's another thing that sort of
the Iranian, there was the Iranian human rights activist, that woman, I forget her name,
with
the long hair, curly hair, who was also people were arrested for also plotting to kill her.
Yes, someone came up to her front door with an AK-47. And this is the second time that people have been arrested trying to kill her because she's the head of the movement like for women to take off the hijab in Iran. And, you know, just all of these things. And to at the same time be signing a deal that lifts sanctions on Iran and gives them even more money to pay people to kill U.S. citizens, it's not a good look.
Doesn't send a good message. This week on the podcast, we are taking a big shift and turn away from Iran and the current news and current events and moving to something that's important, but a bit off our standard path. We're talking to Noam Bedin, who's a native Israeli photojournalist and environmental artist. He started in 2016 something called the Dead Sea Revival Project, which has been recognized by CNN, National Geographic, and NASA for his Dead Sea educational and activism work. And he founded also the Middle East Ecotourism, which received an endorsement from the UAE government. And the reason we're talking to Noam is because there is a lot to talk about when it comes to the Dead Sea and how it's drying up. And it's an issue that we should care about, we should know more about. So Lahav and I have decided to learn a bit about this, and we wanted to talk to Noam Bedin. So here we go. So Noam, it's great to have you on the Jerusalem Post podcast, and we're catching up with you in Italy, in somewhere in Tuscany, in a name of a village that I probably cannot pronounce, so I'm not going to try, but you'll tell us where it is. And you're there because you're presenting a photo exhibition that's part of your work on the Dead Sea. In Italy, in this festival, talking about what's happening and water, the water situation and the climate and things like that. But so tell us just where you are in Italy. But also, I think what our listeners will want to know is this story real? Is the Dead Sea disappearing? Is it really drying up?
All right, Yaakov. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. I'm speaking to you right now from Citerna, which is like a beautiful medieval town in the middle of the Tuscana area.
Citerna, okay.
Where I've been invited to be participating in a local festival on the topic of change. I'm presenting my photography art along with the time lapse of the Dead Sea, showing on one hand the receding of the water level like never seen before, but on the other hand, showing the life and magic that comes out from the Dead Sea. So this is what I'm actually doing here right now in Italy.
Mm-hmm. And the Dead Sea is in fact, I mean, we know it's shrinking, we know it's drying up a bit, but there are, I've read and heard some doomsday scenarios as if by 2050 it's gone, right? Are you as concerned about that?
I mean, it's interesting that people are talking about 2050 when already now, besides the fact it's right now the lowest in recorded history, there is no access to the Northern Dead Sea. You know, growing up in Israel or in a Jewish day school abroad, when people would draw the map of Israel, and when you get to you know, drawing the map, drawing the part of the Dead Sea, you'd get to this tongue kind of shape, and to explain to people that this has been inaccurate for the past over 40 years, it's been two parts of the Dead Sea. This is something even inside Israeli society is not that clear. Meaning when people going to vacationing in the Dead Sea, they go to En Bokeh, to the hotel district, which is a little hard to explain. It's completely artificial. Our entire focus is the Northern Dead Sea, which is the remaining Dead Sea today. And 98% of it is not accessible because of the sinkhole phenomenon. There's been over 7,000 sinkholes throughout the entire shores. Over 700 appear per year. And therefore, there's almost no access to the Dead Sea. Beautiful resorts have been closed off. Closed off. Agricultural areas. On one hand, it's a catastrophe happening in terms of the sinkholes. But on the other hand, life is emerging outside of the Dead Sea, which is something amazing to be exploring and seeing firsthand.
So, what do you mean by that? Life is emerging.
Okay, so sinkholes are basically fresh water springs underneath the Dead Sea. And because the water has been receding, it's actually melting the sediment layers of the Dead Sea, creating cavities, which eventually crumbles into a sinkhole. So the sinkholes are fresh water. But over a period of time, the salinity actually goes down. And you can see many sinkholes, vegetation coming out. And all of a sudden, you know, animals. I literally saw fish on the first time I went to explore the Dead Sea on a boat. I saw actually fish in one of these sinkholes. And that's the contrast of the very powerful story of the Dead Sea. On one hand, it is receding right now in a very fast way. I mean, just to make things very clear, the numbers that we calculate to make things very clear, how much we're losing the Dead Sea per day, the estimated is 600 Olympic pools are dried up every single day in the Dead Sea. Wow. So the changes are very dramatic, to be honest. And doing this for the past 6 years, exploring and documenting the Dead Sea over a period of time, every time you go out, it's a different sea or a different lake.
I swim in a half Olympic size pool, and that's already pretty big. So, you know,
exactly.
Very concerning. But wait, I'm just stuck still on that fish. So the Dead Sea is a place that's, like its name, is dead. But these fish are coming from water that's beneath the Dead Sea?
Well, it's a very good point. There's actually different theories how the fish actually arrive to these sinkholes. I'm not going to get into the details because they're a bit, it's just different interesting theories about it. But the fact is you do have fish in these sinkholes. You do have vegetation coming out. You have bird migration and all the different mammals scattering around in the Judean desert. You can actually find them on the Dead Sea. And guess what? Even in the Dead Sea, it has proven to the scientific world there's actually microorganisms living in the Dead Sea, creating these beautiful, they're called salt chimneys, which are created by the microorganisms in the fresh water going into the Dead Sea. It's a beautiful geological phenomenon to be exposed to, but that's definitely part of the story. So you'd call it the Dead Sea, I mean, to explain also the history of why it's called the Dead Sea, which is a political term used by the Romans at the time, but there's nothing but life that comes out, emerging out from the Dead Sea. Literally life forms in the Dead Sea and on its shores, but at the same time, it really has impact throughout the entire world. How many people know that the minerals are found in the Dead Sea? 26 minerals, when half of these minerals are found only specifically in the Dead Sea. These minerals are exported around to the world, mainly to developing countries, helping these countries to develop their crops for minerals. Minerals helping to build up crops for the agriculture. So it's actually feeding millions of people throughout the entire world. And of course, people around the world coming to the Dead Sea to get healed is not a myth. It's something which is very real. The fact that it's being the lowest point on Earth, it actually has more oxygen. 6 or 8% more oxygen in the lowest point on Earth. This is a huge impact. This has a huge significance to the scientific world, to the therapeutic world. It really is a world treasure. And again, like I said, seeing it from up close, you really understand why it is so special.
But if there's more water coming in now from these sinkholes and there's new vegetation and animals, then maybe it's not so bad that it's changing. I mean, I'm no expert, but everything I've read about it makes it sound like it's a crisis. And you're making it sound like a beautiful thing. So explain it to me. Yeah.
It's a very good point. On one hand, the situation of the Dead Sea is not happening in a natural kind of way. I mean, it just shows the power of nature, the power of creation that's going on in this place. So the fact that the water is receding is not in a natural kind of cause, because of different poor choices that's been happening with the Dead Sea. One hand, the industry, the companies are pumping out the water from the Dead Sea, which is, by the way, not many people realize that both the Israeli and the Jordanian industry companies in the southern part of the Dead Sea is between 25% to 30%. Okay, it's a problem, not the major problem. The main focus that we have to be focusing on is the 70%, which is the sources of the water of the sea has been dried out. The Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, to be honest, the Sea of Galilee, the Kinneret, is not even attached anymore to the Dead Sea like it used to be historically. And the Jordan River, which is the main story over here, has been dried out almost completely, one for drinking purposes, for the thirsty population of Jordan, and for agriculture purposes. So the Dead Sea is receding right now, and not in a natural kind of way. And again, to be honest, even though you do try to put the focus and showing the life coming out, it still can be pretty much dangerous in terms of the more the Dead Sea actually recedes, the air can actually be can be pretty bad, for the entire surrounding. It can get to a certain level, which is in a pretty near future, where the air that the people are breathing in that area can turn into acid, all the way to that extent. And I know this personally by exploring other salt seas in different parts around the world. For instance, the Salton Sea in California, which is considered the worst environmental disaster in California's history. Very similar story to the Dead Sea, what we have in Israel. The same thing with the Salton Sea in California is beginning lack of water because water resources, the Colorado River, is being used for other purposes. The water has been receding, and then eventually it created clouds of dust and winds that created huge environmental and health problems throughout the entire region. So people do not know to what extent this can actually go to. But like I said, in order to have a story that can relate to people in Israel, around the world, you have to show the other side of the story, and that's the life. If you just focus on the catastrophe and showing how everything is very bad, it's very hard to connect to people and get them excited about it.
So, Noam, there's a lot over the years, there's been a lot of initiatives to pump water into the Dead Sea, to connect it to the Red Sea, right? And build Correct. Pipes and canals and things like that. Where does that situation stand? Work has been done to an extent, right? But it's like a big project that would really need Israeli-Jordanian cooperation. We're talking about something big, right?
Correct. And this is where things are actually at the moment. I'm sure that most of our listeners have actually heard about the Red Sea to the Dead Sea, the Red Dead Canal, mm-hmm. Which has been on the table for the past over 25 years. It became a diplomatic project between Israel and Jordan. Actually, the World Bank has promised over $12 billion, building up the largest desalination plant in Aqaba, in Jordan. This has fallen off the table in the past several months, just to make that very clear. As of now, there is no solution.
What happened in the last few months that it fell off the table?
Well, to be honest, Israel was not that keen for this project, because it was not really a project to be saving the Dead Sea, but more saving the Jordanian population for becoming thirsty. And that's part of the story. Meaning, being very realistic, we cannot talk about the Dead Sea if we do not talk about the water situation, of Jordan, the Kingdom of Jordan. And Jordan, overall, is the driest country in the entire region. Overall, this is the driest region in the entire world. And Jordan is like the fourth driest country in the entire world. Meaning, and when the Dead Sea needs enormous amounts of fresh water in order to save it, not salt water, but fresh water, when fresh water is the most valuable asset of the entire region and in the world, as we proceed, is understanding very clearly it's not until a population on the other side of the Dead Sea has enough water for its population for drinking purposes, we cannot talk about saving the Dead Sea. Mm-hmm. So overall, just getting a larger prospect of the Dead Sea, saving the Dead Sea became a humanitarian, for promoting water sustainability of the region. This is how, by the way, the Abraham Accords came into account. It has a direct impact, by the way, in our region.
So you've been involved now in this ecotourism initiative since the Abraham Accords were signed. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, to be honest, the ecotourism was a great tool that actually we started this, the second we started with the Dead Sea over 6 years ago, this became a great tool to be exciting people throughout the world. Because there's only one boat, actually two boats today, one operator on the northern Dead Sea, it became the best way to be exploring the Dead Sea. And of course, with the content behind it, this became a very successful eco tour that today you have to be reserving a space 6 months in advance, all the way to that extent, because it became so popular because there is no access to the Dead Sea. Like we said, 98% is not accessible to the public. So this became a model case for us to be expanding this concept of ecotourism, which became a great way, like we said, having a sightseeing adventure for the general public, when our purpose as a nonprofit is educating and influencing public opinion, ecotourism became a great vehicle for that. Once the Abraham Accords came into account, we thought this will be a great opportunity to be building bridges with our neighboring countries in the region around ecotourism. And there's lots of excitement around that. We got direct, before they had any representatives from Israel, in the UAE or in Israel, we established a relationship with the Climate Change and Environment Ministry of the UAE, and they loved the concept. They gave us a beautiful endorsement letter encouraging us to be creating and building bilateral eco trips between countries, but overall exciting others who are coming to the region to be experiencing and exploring the countries through the lenses, through the eyes of eco and environment, putting the focus on water, because water is the most valuable asset of the entire region.
You're also involved in building a museum for the Dead Sea?
Correct. So our co-founder, Ari Leon Fruchter, he's a co-founder of the Dead Sea Revival Project. His vision is establishing a Dead Sea Museum in Arad. Arad, again, is the gateway in the southern part to the Dead Sea. Most people actually go through that roundabout to travel to the Dead Sea, but Arad became a place for us to be developing its culture and its art. And we have a plan of having an iconic art museum, which hoping all people actually will stop by there. And that's part of it, is observing the cultural aspect of the Dead Sea for generations to come.
Wow. Just before we sign off, tell us, how can people get in touch with you, find out more, do some of these ecotourism trips around the Dead Sea? You said there's a 6 month waiting list, but maybe the listeners of Jerusalem Post, you'll bend the rules. I don't know. I'm just hinting. Where can they find out about this?
Yeah, I mean, it's very easy to look up my name, especially on social media, just Noam Bedin Dead Sea, and easily they can actually reach us. And I'll be honest, these past several years, anybody who searches about activities or ecotours on the Dead Sea, they reach directly to us. Almost every single day, we have people reaching out to us, and we are working on expanding the whole concept of ecotourism for the Dead Sea, creating access for people, also in Israel, but also abroad, coming to visit to explore the Dead Sea and to create access. Okay. So we definitely encourage the people to visit our website, deadsearevival.org, or just look for my name, Noam Dead Sea, and you will find us pretty instantly through Instagram, Facebook. We're pretty much active.
Well, Noam, it was great to have you on the Jerusalem Post podcast.
Yeah, thank you for coming on.
Noam Bedin from the Dead Sea Revival Project. Good luck with the festival. And what's the name of the Italian place again?
Cinterna.
Cinterna. Good luck in Cinterna. And thanks a lot. And people, you should check this out, because this is so important. And Noam's doing a great job. So you'll want to learn more about this. Thanks a lot, Noam.
Thank you, Yaakov. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Jerusalem Post podcast. If you enjoyed, please share with your friends, family, and anyone else who you think might be interested in knowing about what we talk about here. You can find it on Apple, Google, Spotify, and all the other places where podcasts are to be played. We'll see you next week.